Hey, how's it going, guys? Welcome to the show. I'm Scott Horton. It's my show, The Scott Horton Show. That should be a good show for you today. Hang on one second, man. I got to reply to this guy's tweet. Let's see. Here you go. And then control V there. And then, how do I add a picture to this? Can I add a picture to it? Oh, I can't add a picture to it? Oh, that sucks. All right. Anyway. Hey, yeah, so I'm me. This is my show. It's really about how much I hate the government, and especially the Pentagon and the CIA and all the national security state stuff and all the evil things they do to all the innocent people that they do them to. That's basically the shtick. It just so happens the killers are liars. And all their reasons for doing the things that they do aren't good enough, so they have to make up other reasons. It really makes my job pretty easy, because I start with the premise they ain't correct and then work from there, and lo and behold. Anyway, along those lines, Trita Parsi is going to be on the show today to talk about what all Israel can and just might do to thwart the Iran nuclear deal. An increase in military aid, bunch of new fighter jets, not good enough. See what they can do. So, Treat is going to be on to talk about that here in just a minute, actually. Boy, don't let me forget that, man. I always screw up when I guess I don't. But I usually don't start an interview just at the first break there, but I gotta remember that. And then there's a guy named Asa Winstanley. He writes for Electronic Intifada, and he's been keeping a very close watch on all the different stories, compiling them, you might say, all the different stories of Israeli support for Al-Qaeda in Syria. And we've known all along the Israeli policy of preferring Al-Qaeda to Assad. Their ambassador explained it. No problem. Clear as day. But the actual aid and comfort. Well, let's get to some details, shall we? Asa Winstanley will be on the show to talk about that. And then Kathy Kelly is now out of prison. So I thought I would welcome her back to relative freedom. And see if there's any things that she would like to say to people who might be listening. Good old Kathy Kelly. I like her, man. So that's coming up. Now check out this. I got a website, scotthorton.org. You should go there. It should be your home page. I don't know. You can sign up for all the RSS feeds, podcast feeds of just the interviews or the whole show archives, whichever you prefer. You check out my blog, Stress, there, although I admit I don't blog too much. There's some stuff for you there at Stress. And join up the chat room. Hang out with the guys. Ain't too many people in there today. Hi, guys. I mean, I value you each as individuals, of course, but the more individuals, the better. So, scotthorton.org/chat. Stop by, hang out, talk about El Caminos or wars. And, And then check it out. And I gotta remember to say this. I got a new thing where you can help sponsor the show, help support the show by way of Patreon. And at Patreon, you can donate or pledge by the interview. In fact, I got an email that said, man, you should lower your ass to just like, you know, a quarter, 50 cents or whatever, and try to get as many people as you possibly can. Yeah, he's probably right about that. Cause there's quite a volume, right? I'm doing like, I don't know, 80 interviews a month or something like that, somewhere right around there. So, a dollar per interview is pretty steep. But yeah, that's what I'll do. I'll decrease my ask to 50 cents or something, but then you can just, there's one guy signed up, I think, for a quarter. Quarter per interview. Shiny new quarter. Old quarters. Whichever. So that's a cool thing, man. Patreon. And I need to remember to say that at the beginning of some of these interviews so people listening to the podcast archive later remember, get a chance to hear it too. Just had a few people sign up so far, but seems like a cool thing. Patreon. And then for crying out loud, man, you can buy transcripts of interviews that you hear on this show. I got to remember to say that before the interviews, too. so that they get included in the interview only podcasts. You can get transcripts. $2.50.
That's fair, right?
And then I want to do a thing. I think, I was thinking, makes sense to me. For some of you in some of you hardcore fans, $150 and you get, from now on, any transcript that anybody else orders and gets written up, you get one too. A lifetime subscription. Maybe that's a little steep. Maybe it should just be $50 or $75 or some kind of thing. I don't know. We'll let the market decide. And then check out this. Will Grigg is starting a live show to take place right after my show daily here on the Liberty Radio Network. How do you like that? The great William Norman Grigg, formerly the best bircher, but then they got rid of him because he was good on all border issues. So they've canned him in 2006, which has only been good for Liberty. Maybe not so good for his career as far as finances go. He's become, I think, much more libertarian. He already was very libertarian and not so right-wing, I think, back then. But he's just been getting more and more libertarian all the time. And he's on the police abuse beat and among the best journalismists. He's among the best journalismists in the country on the issue of cops getting away with blue bloody murder. Literal and figurative. Freedominourtime.blogspot.com. The great Will Grigg. And he's going to have a show. He's going to come on right after me. Ain't that cool? That is cool. And you know what you could do? You could help support Will Grigg. He needs equipment. I mean, I think he's got kind of bare bones, but he needs equipment, and he needs, you know, obviously a good international calling plan, and there are costs with putting together a good radio show. But, you know, if you guys are fans of this show, then it's pretty much kind of a guarantee that you must love Will Grigg, because he's obviously among the best of the guests I have. He's as well-spoken as he is a great writer. And, he's just good on liberty and identifying at, the problems, what's going wrong. He's awesome, right? The great Will Grigg. So go to his website. It's freedominourtime.blogspot.com. Freedominourtime.blogspot.com. And, help support Will Grigg. Chip in some money there. Help, it's kind of a rolling start here. He's going to be getting the show going. I believe it should be starting next week. I was really hoping he'd start today, but I guess that didn't work out. But anyway, the great Will Grigg. Isn't that great? He's going to be live on LRN daily. That's good. And by the way, if you're the advertising sort, you should advertise on my show and his show. You should advertise on his show and my show. And then we'll all have advertisements and money. Right? That's my philosophy. All right, so, the great Will Grigg, freedominourtime.blogspot.com. At the bottom of each article and in the right-hand margin, you can find the PayPal button. So, it's a matter of marginal utility. The more money you got, the easier it is to part with enough to say, you know, really help Will Grigg out, maybe. So, if you're as broke as the rest of us, then, hey, you know, how about a few bucks? Couldn't hurt. Definitely help him. Couldn't hurt you too bad, right? But if you got a lot of money, give him a lot of money, man. Or give him some. And then you'll still have a lot. Right? We're talking about Will Grigg here. Is it not important that he continue to be, a pillar? A libertarian institution in this society? All right, then. Thank you. We'll be right back with Trita in just a sec. Hey, I'm Scott Horton here to tell you about this great new book by Michael Swanson, The War State. In The War State, Swanson examines how Presidents Truman, Eisenhower, and Kennedy both expanded and fought to limit the rise of the new national security state after World War II. This nation is ever to live up to its creed of liberty and prosperity for everyone. We are going to have to abolish the empire. Know your enemy. Get The War State by Michael Swanson. It's available at your local bookstore or at Amazon.com in Kindle or in paperback. Just click the book in the right margin at scotthorton.org or thewarstate.com. Hey, I'll Scott Horton here. It's always safe to say that one should keep at least some of your savings in precious metals as a hedge against inflation. And if this economy ever does heat back up and the banks start expanding credit, rising prices could make metals a very profitable bet. Since 1977, Robertson Roberts Brokerage, Inc. has been helping people buy and sell gold, silver, platinum, and palladium, and they do it well. They're fast, reliable, and trusted for more than 35 years. And they take Bitcoin. Call Robertson Roberts at 1-800-874-9760 or stop by rrbi.co. All right, guys, welcome back to the show. I'm Scott Horton. It's my show, The Scott Horton Show. Getting right to the interviews here with Trita Parsi, founder and president of the National Iranian American Council. That's NIAcouncil.org, NIAcouncil.org. He's got the spotlight today on antiwar.com with Paul Pilar. It's at the Huffington Post. The Iran talks game changer, an Israeli-Hezbollah war. Now, Trita, we only got 5 minutes, and so two things for you to address here. First of all, the announcement yesterday that the French want to throw up new roadblocks to the negotiation and demand, more access to military sites, possibly or clearly unrelated to nuclear material under the agreement, or they're going to throw a monkey wrench in it there. And then, obviously, this gigantic headline that you've got here at the Huffington Post. So please go ahead, sir.
Yeah, so essentially what we're arguing is that, mindful of the failure of the opponents of the deal to kill it in Washington, and it's looking bad for them right now, what they may be looking for is a game changer. And something that could qualify as a game changer is if there would be a military confrontation between Israel and Hezbollah. I mean, see the argument that they're using right now, that a deal would lift sanctions on Iran and give it a bunch of money that it will end up giving to Hezbollah. That's an argument that so far hasn't resonated that well. But once you have a situation in which Hezbollah rockets are hitting Israel, it is plausible that it suddenly will become much more potent. And in an act of desperation, combined with several other factors, the fact that Hezbollah is arming itself right now, but at the same time is very weak because it's overextended due to its involvement in Syria, and the fact that there is a very strong argument, a strong campaign being made in Israel right now to try to justify a preemptive attack against Hezbollah, which is made by people inside the government right now saying it's better to attack them now than to wait for them to attack Israel. We're making the argument that potentially this could happen, but the driver of it, the decisive driver, would be to try to kill the Iran deal by shifting the momentum in the Iran debate in Washington.
Mm-hmm. Now, as far as the rhetoric inside Israel, is it much hotter than usual on this issue?
It has picked up, and it's interesting in the specificity of it. You know, they're looking at the number of rockets, to pointing out the weakness of Hezbollah elsewhere, and then making the argument that Israel should not have to wait to be attacked. They essentially say that the confrontation with Hezbollah is inevitable, then it's better for it to be at the time of choosing of Israel rather than for Israel to wait to get attacked. Mm-hmm. And we've seen this before. There's been plenty of times in which there has been that type of a noise out of Israel and nothing has happened. And then there's been time in which that noise has been there, and then later on it did happen. So we're not making the argument that this is going to happen. We're making the argument that if it does happen, it could actually be motivated not just by Hezbollah's rockets, but by a desire, a calculation that it will help kill the Iran deal in Washington.
Mm-hmm. Makes good sense. Okay, now, so what about the French? Are they really going to screw this thing up?
Look, the French always try to position themselves as the ones that are tougher than anyone else on the nuclear issue. Oftentimes, frankly, it's just a lot of rhetoric. There has been cases in which they have come in and they have sabotaged things, but that's not necessarily because they were more hawkish than the other side. It was, frankly, more because of them deliberately going in there and disagreeing with things that already had been established.
Mm-hmm.
You're going to see a lot of drama, a tremendous amount of drama between now and end of June from both sides. And there's going to be talks about, oh, we need more time to negotiate. Essentially, what is happening when you reach the climax of a major negotiation like this is that they start to negotiate at least part of it in public with a lot of psychological signals. And that's what we're seeing right now. The French have said that there's no way we can finish this by June. The Iranians come out and say we probably will need more time. They're essentially saying time is on our side, so we're okay with extending the negotiations. Mm-hmm. Reality is time is on no one's side. This deal needs to be struck as quickly as possible.
Well, and so you're saying that the French are in a position that they can back down from. They're not really, I mean, isn't it obvious that that's sabotage, right? To say we have to be able to go wherever we want to your military bases.
Yeah. I mean, look, there's going to be some inspections of military sites because that's already included in the additional protocol. The question now is if there's a request to go way beyond that. And that could be a very tough negotiation. And the Iranians may not give in. The Iranians may give in. The French may not give in. The French may give in. I mean, it remains to be seen. But none of the things that we've seen so far are so serious that they would have a significant chance of killing the negotiations. The real threat to the negotiations is what's going to happen in the Senate and in Congress after a deal is struck.
Right. Okay. Thanks for coming back on the show. I sure appreciate it.
Thank you so much for having me.
See ya. That's Trita Parsi. Y'all, he is the founder and the president of the National Iranian American Council. That's NIAcouncil.org. And it's the spotlight today on antiwar.com. The Iran talks game changer. An Israeli Hezbollah war. And it's co-authored again with Paul Pilar, the former CIA analyst, whose signature is on that NIE, that Iraq NIE of 02, but who's been, I think, trying to do penance mostly since then. Very problematically problematic. And now, here's what's funny about this, and we're going to be getting into this discussion with our next guest, Asa Winstanley, right after the break here. The only other Hezbollah headline I can find today reads, Hezbollah drone strike kills, oh my God, Hezbollah drone strike kills three Al-Qaeda on Lebanon-Syria border. Says the group was planning a terrorist attack near Arsal. In a move showing the Shiite militia faction's growing capabilities, Hezbollah has released a video showing it carried out a drone strike against fighters of Al-Qaeda's Nusra Front. Killing three. Well, maybe that's why Israel needs to hurry up and start a war. They can preempt some missiles, quote unquote. They can try to scotch the Iran talks, and they can help save their friends in Al-Qaeda in Syria, really? Yeah, really. How much time do I got to play this? Very little. Yeah, well. See if I can get a little bit of this going for you here. This is Michael Oren, Likud ambassador.
We have to choose the lesser of evils here. The lesser evil is the Sunnis over the Shiites. It's an evil, believe me. It's a terrible evil. Again, they've just taken out 1,700 former Iraqi soldiers and shot them in a field. But who are they fighting against? They're fighting against the proxy with Iran that's complicit in the murder of 160,000 people in Syria. You can just, you know, do the math. And again, one side is armed with suicide bombers and rockets. The other side has access to military nuclear capabilities. So from Israel's perspective, if there's got to be an evil that's going to prevail, you know, let the Sunni evil prevail.
Yeah. So it's clear he's not talking about any mythical moderates there. He's deliberately describing the Islamic State and the al-Nusra Front head shopper suicide bombers, specifically referring to massacres by the Islamic State. And why prefer them? Because Iran has a military nuclear capability, which is a pure lie, a ridiculous fantasy. What a great excuse. Michael Oren, former Israeli ambassador to the U.S. Hey, all Scott here. If you're like me, you need coffee. Lots of it. And you probably prefer it tastes good, too. Well, let me tell you about Darren's Coffee Company at darrenscoffee.com. Darren Marion is a natural entrepreneur who decided to leave his corporate job and strike out on his own, making great coffee. And Darren's Coffee is now delivering right to your door. Darren gets his beans direct from farmers around the world. All specialty, premium grade, with no filler. Hey, the man just wants everyone to have a chance to taste this great coffee. darrenscoffee.com. Use promo code Scott and you get free shipping. darrenscoffee.com. In America today, teachers, cops, judges, and other so-called public servants make far more than the average taxpayer. And their pensions? Well, if the people knew, they'd join us. That's where you come in. Taxpayers United of America is embarking on a great new project to train activists how to take on the parasites in your communities. The entire process, from prying loose the facts to disseminating the truth to the people. The next one is June 13th in Denver. It's just $5 if you sign up now at taxpayersunited.org/govpensions. Well, god dang. My guest had to cancel. Well, things more important than this show came up. I understand. Okay, no problem, though. He's going to be on tomorrow. Which means tomorrow's going to be a great show because we're going to have Trevor Tim on, too. Did I already tell you that? Trevor Tim's going to be on tomorrow. Talk about the Patriot Act and all that. And then Asa Winstanley will join us to talk about Israeli support for the Al-Nusra Front after that. Or before that, or whichever it is. I forget. Okay, so that's all right. And we still got Kathy Kelly coming up. And we can look forward to that. That's what I think. All right. So, look at that. Yeah. Oh, okay. Well, I got so much to talk about. I'm actually kind of glad he canceled in a sick silver lining kind of sense because, there's so much coming out, to talk about. First of all, let me say this. Did you guys know that there's some brand new WikiLeaks? And guess what they are? It's 500,000 State Department cables. That's virtually the same amount that Chelsea Manning leaked, right? But they're all from 1978. Now, the only actual piece of news that I know out of them yet was sent to me by a friend on Twitter this morning. It's Henry Kissinger, and this State Department cable says, "Before the Freedom of Information Act, I used to say at meetings, the illegal we do immediately, the unconstitutional takes a little longer." Laughter. "But since the Freedom of Information Act, I'm afraid to say things like that." And what's funny about that is, if you're the kind of person who hates the state, then you know that quote. You know it very well. But it's always, I think, just kind of apocryphal. If anybody knows the original source for that, maybe somebody who was around in the 70s remembers the original source for that quote. But I've always just heard that as like, Kissinger said it, everybody knows he said it. It doesn't matter whether he really said it or not, because it might as well have said it, that kind of thing. Well, here it is in the goddamn cables, man. "The illegal we do immediately. The unconstitutional takes a little longer." That suggests to me that he should be in prison. Is that just me? I mean, I know he's a government official, so the law doesn't really apply to him at all, but former government official? Is there such a thing? He's a made man. He's on the inside. But now here's what I wonder. What all interesting stuff is in here? This is all during Camp David Accords and everything, man. Remember, giving up the West Bank and the Gaza Strip for a Palestinian state was supposed to be part of the same Camp David Accords from back then. There's going to be all kinds of stuff in here. I don't know yet who's doing a great job digging through them and doing the reporting on them. There's 500,000 cables. Who's going to do the work? Not this guy. So somebody better get to it. And hurry up. And then the other thing is, there must be a new source, right? This isn't Manning stuff. Somehow, WikiLeaks got their hands on 500,000 cables from 1978. What other years worth of 500,000's worth of cables might they have? Are there more coming? Did they say if there's more coming? Did they say that there's not more coming? I think there must be more coming. Who's going to leak just 1978 unless there's something massive buried in there that is the real reason for the leak of the whole thing or something like that, right? But if somebody lifted all of 78, then they must have lifted much more. And if they gave it all to WikiLeaks and WikiLeaks put 500,000 cables up at once from 1978... then does that not imply to you that there's more coming? What if there's a lot more coming? This could be a lot of fun. Yeah, you know, America, it's a corrupt evil empire, and the difference between the things that it says and the things that it does, vast. So, in other words, there's a lot of room for a lot of news stories. Maybe hundreds and hundreds of thousands of them. You know, the Manning cables are the gift that keep on giving to this day. You read news stories that say, well, State Department cables from this and that, they never even go back and say thanks, Bradley, or nothing but Chelsea. But they go, yeah, that does verify this one part of our story we're working on from, quote, this or that, whatever. And now here's another thing I wanted to see real quick, man, is that I got this movie off the Pirate Bay. It's called Parallels, and it was pretty poorly done, man. It had so much potential. It was a building that traveled through different dimensions, like on sliders. And apparently, in many, many, many of these dimensions, there's been a thermonuclear war. And I guess they're supposed to be in L.A.? It's kind of a confused mixed signal in the movie, whether they're in L.A. or not. Wherever they are, they've been nuked. And the story was, well, the Pakistani regime fell and all their nukes got loose and went out all over the place. And then somebody set one off in, I guess, L.A.? I don't know. And then, so, the thing of it is, and then somebody says, I'm ruining the movie for you. It's already pretty much a failure anyway, so don't worry about it. And somebody says, oh yeah, you know, we traveled through all these different dimensions, and there's a lot of different dimensions where there's been a thermonuclear war. Usually it was a U.S. versus USSR thing in the 60s or 70s, but in this case, it was the Pakistani nukes got loose. Started it. That was the story, right? And so then it occurred to me that actually if you really did have a thing where there was a bunch of different Earths and a bunch of different dimensions, that yeah, probably assuming the 20th century Cold War, there probably would be quite a few of them where there had been a full-scale thermonuclear war. And here's the thing of it. Well, I mean, it's a stupid movie. But the important point of it is that it's worth considering from time to time. That we, the Americans, the Russians, the British, the Israelis, Indians, Pakistanis, Chinese, the French, we let our governments hold on to these nukes. We failed to do everything that it takes to stop them from continuing to hold on to these nukes. And it's just absolute madness that this is still a policy. In the height of, mass delusion in 1959 or whatever, I don't approve, but I understand. But man, the Cold War with China has been over since 1974. The Cold War with Russia has been over since 1989. 89! And we still got these nukes? The Israelis could whoop the ass of every single one of their state neighbors unendingly without using a single nuke. For years, they could fight them and win. Give me a break. And the most likely place on Earth for there to be a nuclear war would be between India and Pakistan, where they really do not have very good red phone communication with each other to prevent this kind of thing. And it just seems like, I mean, what the hell, man? If Superman was here, he would say, it's time. I'm throwing these goddamn things in the sun right now. We're done with this. This is insanity. And you know what? I know I sound like some commie simp hippie, you know, enemy of America, whatever. But all I'm doing is being reasonable. You know, let the government, you know, let politicians and military officers control nuclear weapons or hell, for that matter, energy department employees. You know, let them own nuclear weapons. The kind of bombs that could kill L.A., thermonukes, H-bombs, a 20 megaton H-bomb could kill L.A., could kill Dallas or Houston or one of these entire megalopolises. Why would we let our governments have those nukes? And why would stopping them not be our first priority? I kind of can't understand that. Anyway, I'll see you in 4 minutes. Hang tight right there. Phone records, financial and location data, Prism, Tempora, X-Keyscore, Boundless Informant. Hey, y'all, Scott Horton here for offnow.org. Now, here's the deal. Due to the Snowden revelations, we have a great opportunity for a short period of time to get some real rollback of the national surveillance state. Now, they're already trying to tire us by introducing fake reforms in the Congress. And the courts, they betrayed their sworn oaths to the Constitution and Bill of Rights again and again, and can in no way be trusted to stop the abuses for us. We've got to do it ourselves. How? We nullify it at the state level. It's still not easy, but the off-now project of the 10th Amendment Center has gotten off to a great start. I mean it. There's real reason to be optimistic here. They've gotten their model legislation introduced all over the place, in state after state. I've lost count, more than a dozen. You're always wondering, yeah, but what can we do? Here's something. Something important. Something that can work if we do the work. Get started cutting off the NSA support in your state. Go to offnow.org.
Don't you get sick of the Israel lobby trying to get us into more wars in the Middle East? Or always abusing Palestinians with your tax dollars? It once seemed like the lobby would always have full-spectrum dominance on the foreign policy discussion in D.C. But those days are over. The Council for the National Interest is the America lobby, standing up and pushing back against the Israel lobby's undue influence on Capitol Hill. Go show some support at councilforthenationalinterest.org. That's councilforthenationalinterest.org.
All right, guys, welcome back. I'm Scott Horton. It's my show, Scott Horton Show. So, yeah, that's unfortunate. Our guest had to cancel. He had something came up there, but that's all right. Just gives me more time to cover more news before Kathy Kelly gets here. Well, not that she's going to get here. I'm going to call her, but you know what I mean. Before it's Kathy Kelly time. But then, yeah, you're going to want to read this guy, Asa Wynn Stanley. Here he is. Why is the media ignoring Israel's alliance with Al-Qaeda? Dope. Memo. MiddleEastMonitor.com. He's going to be on the show tomorrow. All right, now, I'm sorry. I got to talk about Rand Paul. I can't help it. It's important, kind of. You know what? Never even mind that he's Ron Son and what a disappointment he is and all that stuff. You know, I could go on forever about that. I have before and I could still and start again right now. But that ain't the thing. The thing is that here he is. He's really got himself in a fight with all of the other Republicans now. And he better because, I mean, I don't know, man. It's sort of like the fun in watching Hillary flop around like a dying fish from, you know, between now and 18 months from now. Like, it's... I got the Schadenfreude. I think it's a barrel of monkeys. But the Rand thing, I have such highs and lows with Rand because he has such a high position that when he does the right thing, like standing up against the Patriot Act, apparently successfully killing Section 215. I mean, that is some heroic stuff, man. It's an important thing to be a senator and be really good on something really bad like that. Man. But there's so much at stake in every area of American political life right now in terms of the policy of what our government is up to, and especially in foreign policy, that, you know, these discussions are huge. Even if he wasn't running for president, just fighting and saying some of the things that he says as a senator... they make news every time. They cannot be ignored. This is not Jim Traficant going, "Beam me up, Scotty," from the floor of the House. This is a United States senator, and he's thrown down the gauntlet on a few very important things. And they pick the fight with him. And the thing is it's a million to one, but he's the one who's got truth on his side if he would quit pandering and just, you know, be hardcore, you know, be consistent, starting with the things that he's good on. And carry that over to the other things, too. He's got right, and they got everybody. But he ought to simply be looking at that like, you know, just great. It's a bunch of limp-wristed, draft-dodging Republicans throwing softballs at him. And you can just knock him out of the park all damn day long. You want to argue with me about Libya, really? Lindsey Graham wants to argue with me. The guy who supported this wants to argue with me, the guy who opposed it. All right, let's do this. It's his only hope. And the thing is, apparently he's starting to understand that. I don't want to conclude that. But he keeps fighting. And, you know, he is kind of such a snooty little douche that he makes everything very personal. And, you know, he's got very thin skin, whether it's Lindsey Graham or John McCain or whether it's a female news anchor lady. And so it gets very personal. He doesn't even say, you know, this mistaken policy has led to ISIS. He says, these guys have created ISIS, right? He says it in a way where it's just, they have to fight now. So my point is this, my question, I guess, is this, is he going to learn sooner than later that pandering doesn't work? Or maybe the better question would be, is he going to learn sooner than later that the current path of trying to split the difference on everything doesn't work? That he has to either choose hardcore pander, any compromise I could possibly make to try for the power, or go ahead and put up your dukes. And that those are your only two choices. Then which will he choose if he could even figure that out? Because I think he's in the position, right, where every other right wing, and there's like 20 guys, there's so many Republicans trying to run for the nomination right now. And all of them, Jindal came out yesterday or the day before, all of them are using Rand Paul as their foil. Rand Paul, why? He's a weakling. Why? He reminds me of a Democrat. They're all saying that. So what can he do other than say, no, I'm smart and you're all fools. You, and you, bring it. Come on. We could argue about Afghanistan. We could argue about torture. We could argue about surveillance. We could argue about Iraq and ISIS and Syria and Libya and Saudi Arabia and Yemen and Somalia and bring it. And now, you know, the real qualification here is that Rand better buckle down and do his reading and his homework. Because just reciting his impression of things is not going to cut it. Remember when he accused John McCain of palling around with ISIS? Well, he wasn't palling around with ISIS. He was palling around with the Free Syrian Army, including the Northern Storm Brigade, who, yes, in fact, were veterans of Al-Qaeda in Iraq. And their leader admitted to Time magazine before John McCain even went there that, yeah, I fought the Americans in the Iraq War, in Iraq War II. And now I'm, you know, leading this group against Assad. Da 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 da. There it is. You just type in Northern Storm and Time, and there it is. And that was up before McCain ever went. Now, these guys were veterans of Al-Qaeda in Iraq. We found out later that not only had they kidnapped civilian pilgrims from Lebanon, Shiite pilgrims from Lebanon, but they also had kidnapped Stephen Sotloff and sold him to the Islamic State. So in other words, if Rand had had his act together, he had three or four huge arguments against McCain's position in Syria. Oh, yeah, you want to fight with me, McCain? Well, here's what you think and say and want. He could have blamed him. And instead, he went off his impression of what he thought he heard somewhere or something, some meme going around on Facebook without any substance to it, and he overshot and blew it. When none of those guys in that picture are ISIS guys. They're all horrible as hell. But they're not ISIS guys. It's just different people is all. So, the truth matters in all different directions. And anyway, so my point is that, Rand, you might as well just become your dad, dude, because you got no choice now. They're all coming for you. It's 20-1. You might as well just say, you know what? You're wrong on the West Bank, too. The Palestinians live there. That's your first clue. It belongs to them. The fact that the settlers are called settlers is an admission that they just got there and that they're trespassing on private property, okay? As long as it's 20-1. I mean, what's he going to do? Be good on half the wars? Who's that going to please? You know, he said again. Now, he said this back before. But Dan Sanchez just tweeted to me yesterday. I think he said again that Snowden and Clapper ought to be in the same cell together. Oh, come on. If what Clapper was doing was wrong, lying under oath before the United States Imperial Senate about whether they're collecting all our phone records or not, if that is wrong, then Snowden telling the truth about it is right. Simple as that. And not that if what Snowden did was wrong, that necessarily acquits the director of national intelligence because he could have told the truth or said, well, I'll talk about that in a classified setting or whatever, right? Tell you off the record, Senator. But he lied. He perjured himself. But, you know, anyway. For people to take the side of the state against Edward Snowden, to me, I mean, for crying out loud, man, really? Have you never ate magic mushrooms in your whole life or anything and try to figure out who's who in relation to what or anything? Yeah, two whats. Oh, that terrible Snowden. He's a traitor. How dare he tell us that they're violating the law and all of our rights all day, every day? Why, he's a traitor to me for telling me the truth about people who are assaulting me, committing crimes against me. A government no longer pretending to be bound by the charter that created it, that forbids any such thing as general surveillance warrants. Get the hell out of here. Just don't understand how people can be so impressionable, you know? Alright, so let's see. Trevor Tim's coming on about the Patriot Act tomorrow. Will Grigg. Donate to Will Grigg, Trevor Tim, WikiLeaks, Trita. Nusra rebranding. Oh, I didn't get to that, but I have a good story about Nusra rebranding. That'll be coming up in just a few. But Kathy Kelly's coming up. Talk about her time in prison. Talked about Rand. Oh, and the benchmarks. Got to do the benchmarks.
So you're a libertarian, and you don't believe the propaganda about government awesomeness you were subjected to in fourth grade. You want real history and economics. Well, learn in your car from professors you can trust with Tom Woods's Liberty Classroom. And if you join through the Liberty Classroom link at scotthorton.org, we'll make a donation to support the Scott Horton Show. Liberty Classroom, the history and economics they didn't teach you.
Hey, y'all, Scott Horton here for Liberty.me, the social network and community-based publishing platform for the liberty-minded. Liberty.me combines the best of social media technology all in one place and features classes, discussions, guides, events, publishing, podcasts, and so much more. And Jeffrey Tucker and I are starting a new monthly show at Liberty.me, Eye on the Empire. It's just $4 a month if you use promo code Scott when you sign up. And hey, once you do, add me as a friend on there at scotthorton.liberty.me. Be free. Liberty.me.
All right, you guys, welcome back to the show. I'm Scott Horton. It's my show, The Scott Horton Show. Our next guest is Kathy Kelly, co-coordinator of Voices for Creative Nonviolence. That is VCNV.org. Welcome back to the show. Kathy, how are you doing?
Hello, Scott. Good to be on your show. Thank you.
Good. Happy to have you back. Now, you just got out of the penitentiary. How could you do it, Kathy?
Well, the military lawyer said Miss Kelly is in great need of rehabilitation. And actually, I was arrested 3 days after I was released out at Beale Air Force Base and then took off for Afghanistan. So in a way, I was rehabilitated. I think it's good to remember what it's like to be somebody living in a prison and how hard it is for the people that are trapped there.
Well, tell us about that, first of all.
Well, thank you. You know, the prison system is so futile. The place that I was locked up in was one that I think they've pretty much given up on. They call it the armpit of the system. And I don't mean to complain about conditions. The most onerous thing is really the length of sentencing, the dreariness and the isolation, the loneliness. Well, here I am at a house of hospitality here in New York where others use the same phone line. Excuse that. Anyway, the women in prison are so full of remorse because they're separated from their children. It's a very painful place for people to be. And, I mean, I must say for the men also, the median sentence length at Pekin Prison for Men, where I was last in prison before this most recent time, the median sentence length was 27 years. So people enter into these systems and they'll be grandparents before they emerge.
Well, in talking to the people in there, were they in there for, you know, doing horrible things to other people or just for offenses against some bureaucrat or what?
Well, the shorthand was kind of, are you in for money or drugs? And if people committed a money crime, it wasn't anything compared to what the big banksters have done in our more recent history. And yes, women got involved in drug trafficking and drug use. They hurt themselves. They hurt immediate family members. But they were not even anywhere near posing a threat to the security for somebody like me living my ordinary life, or probably you or most of your listeners. But why does this prison industrial complex go on? Well, you know, every year, every university across the country tends to graduate a new group of lawyers. And how are you going to keep all of the lawyers and all the wardens and the prison guards and the prison architects and the corporations getting close to slave labor? How are you going to keep them all in the loop of profiting? We have to have prisoners. And I think that's part of the reason why we continue this so-called war on drugs, which has been so futile. It's broken the lives of many, many people, the broken communities. It's raised the numbers of people who've been impoverished. And certainly it hasn't made it less likely that a new wave of drugs will come into the country with the influx of heroin. And while we're spending so much money in Afghanistan making a war there, Afghanistan is now supplying 80 to 90% of the world's heroin. So the solutions that the United States people have been asked to pay for don't work.
Yeah. In fact, I was just doing a show the other day where a guy in the chat room said, "Hey, I just got back from Afghanistan, and my whole tour was just standing around guarding a warlord's opium, poppy fields."
Isn't that incredible?
Real eye-opening tour of duty for him, you know?
And meanwhile, I just got back from Afghanistan, and I'd say my main duty was to have my shoulder available while women sobbed and sobbed and sobbed for many reasons. Oh, I'm so sorry. Could I keep this line for a little longer? Thank you.
You're very polite.
Scott, you're a patient person.
Yeah, no problem. Hey, it's live radio. These things happen. I don't get upset. And I just love talking with you anyway. So now remind us again, this government that, locks all these people up in cages for drugs, as you described, why do they lock you in a cage?
Well, I had thought it was appropriate to exercise my First Amendment right to, assemble peaceably for redress of grievance. Georgia Walker and I bought a loaf of bread, which is quite symbolic of the way that Afghans settle in for every meal. There's always a big wheel of bread. And so we bought that kind of bread to the Whiteman Air Force Base. And we wanted to talk with the commander of the base. We felt it was important to talk with somebody who had authority over the squadrons that were flying drones, weaponized drones over Afghanistan. And we wanted to know how many people were killed in Afghanistan, if any, on that day. And how do their manuals help the pilots distinguish between somebody who is an armed combatant and somebody who isn't? We wanted to ask questions about what they do when people say, we don't want to do this kind of work anymore. And we know that they're having a very hard time filling the jobs of piloting drones, because many say, look, I'm traumatized. I'm, 7,000 miles away from the war zone, and I'm 18 inches away from the war zone. So we had questions, but the commander of the base felt that we were trespassing by being there at all. We were arrested. And I think the judge in my case felt that his prior responsibility was to protect the weapons and protect the base, whereas I think his job really is to protect our First Amendment rights to speak up when we believe that murder and assassination are taking place.
Right. Well, and not just believe, but know for sure.
Thank you. Well, that's certainly true. There are plenty of reports that have come out that are reliable, like the Reprieve report, that show that when U.S. officials have said, oh, the numbers of civilians killed are in the single digits, that's just a bald-faced lie. And you can't say it's the fog of war and they get mixed up. I mean, these are static targets that are being hit with the desire to be precise, I suppose. But in fact, time and again, civilians out collecting fuel on a mountainside or riding in a convoy to go and get health care and having left early in the morning, there's confusion. There's uncertainty. You know, are these people that might threaten people? Hi, could I just keep this line a little longer? Thank you.
Just
if anybody ever
minutes.
Comes to New York and wants to visit Mary House Catholic Worker, it's a wonderful spot.
I understand.
The phones are shared.
No problem.
Yeah. Anyway, the mistakes that have been made have certainly caused good reason for concern, along with the concern about proliferation. You know, these weaponized drones aren't something that only the United States is going to be controlling. And once upon a time, you know, the U.S. was the only one with the nuclear bomb, and look at us now. So what kind of future are we heading into? I suppose I maybe could mention that one of the great ironies for me is that a new way to get contraband into the prisons is through flying it in with a drone. I read that in the New York Times.
Yeah, I've seen a couple of things, too, along those lines. Well, great. So it sure is good to have you back on the show and back here to relative freedom compared to being locked in the pen. I'm glad they didn't keep you that long in there, but I am sorry that they put you in there at all. Although the silver lining, of course, is now you're even better informed as an anti-prison activist, too, so we can all benefit from that.
Well, thanks. I think that there's good reason for activists to go inside the prison system, because I think we've got a war against the poor going on in this country. You know, people in my generation couldn't help but feel a little encouraged and inspired, I think, by a war on poverty. And we thought that there would be this reservoir of goodwill that the U.S. would create, and, you know, that hunger and disease could be eradicated from our world. And it's gone in a very opposite direction. And I think
the poor have a lot of money to, so it makes a lot of sense for the government to prey on them. You know, it's all about volume, right?
And well, it really is. I'm glad you used that word prey. A fellow recently wrote a book called The Locust Effect, talking about the predatory nature of how people bully and pick on the most vulnerable people in society. But you know, some would conclude, well, then lock those people up. But I think that the prisons ought to be abolished. Yeah. I'm not in favor of any prisons. We can always find better alternatives for helping people figure out wiser ways to live their lives.
Absolutely. All right. Well, thank you so much. It's great to have you back on the show.
Thank you, Scott. I will allow
you to allow these others to use the phone now.
Okay.
But I
thank you.
Do appreciate your time again on the show, Kathy.
All right, Scott. Bye-bye.
Yeah. Very happy she's out of jail now. That's Kathy Kelly. She's at Voices for Creative Nonviolence, vcnv.org. Hey, I'm Scott Horton here for The Future of Freedom, the monthly journal of the Future Freedom Foundation at fff.org/subscribe. Since 1989, FFF has been pushing an uncompromising moral and economic case for peace, individual liberty, and free markets. Sign up now for The Future Freedom, featuring founder and president Jacob Hornberger, as well as Sheldon Richmond, James Bovard, Anthony Gregory, Wendy McElroy, and many more. It's just $25 a year for the print edition, $15 per year to read it online. That's fff.org/subscribe. And tell them Scott sent you. Yeah, so hey, welcome back to my show. It's my show.
Cool, man.
All right. So, it looks like Ray McGovern has a new piece out about the myth of the surge, which I'm sure is good because I talked to him about it at the time and he was good on it. But I'll tell you what I'm going to do. You might hate this. You might like it. I don't know. But I got an email yesterday from a guy named Jonathan. And Jonathan says to me, "Hey, man, I need a little bit of help arguing about whether the surge worked or not. I found an article from McClatchy," it's Nancy Youssef, our friend, great journalist, "from mid-2007, evaluating the progress being made at that time. However, I was wondering if you are a guest on the show, and maybe we'll get Ray on tomorrow." Let me write that down so I ain't forget about it. "You or a guest on the show could evaluate those benchmarks from the 2011 perspective when the American troops were actually pulled out of Iraq by Obama. My thought being that at that point, the government fully stood behind the stance that the surge had worked. As Obama said, it worked like a dream." Barack Obama. "Any chance you could go over what parts were met or not met at that time? I think it would help greatly as ammunition when debating people on that point. Thanks, as always." Okay, so here's what I done told him. "Jonathan, the benchmarks were one," and this is at the dawn of the surge, 2007. "The benchmarks were to be met by fall." So starting in January 2007. "Rumsfeld gone, Gates in, Fat Neck, Fred Kagan, and General Jack Keane, and David Petraeus and their counterinsurgency doctrine, right? 30,000 more troops. The benchmarks
were supposed to be, one, finally end the fighting in Baghdad so that, two, political reconciliation between factions through the magic of parliamentary democracy, and then, three, they would use this new wave of compromising to integrate the new independent Sunni army, the Sons of Iraq, or concerned local citizens, into the now completely Shiite army of the new government. Oh yeah, and four, pass an oil law giving total power over it to the central government, which will, five, be an American client forever, and six, allow at least 56 permanent bases from which to threaten Iran, Syria, etc. That's my summation of what the benchmarks were, how we would know whether the surge worked at anything other than getting people to repeat a slogan. Well, it does have three words. I like slogans with three words. Score. Number one. Well, they finish helping the Shiites ethnically cleanse Baghdad of Sunnis, that is, kill them, leading to the peace of desolation being achieved. But the extra 30,000 soldiers didn't really make the difference there. It was just a matter of time. They'd been fighting that civil war for years at that point. And at least half points off for fighting an entire stupid mini-war against Sadr's men in East Baghdad at the same time as they were fighting for him in the rest of the country, and while he was the least of the Iran-tied and loyal of all the factions the U.S. was siding with, and that being the United Iraqi Alliance that won the elections of 2005, and the United Iraqi Alliance being made up of the Supreme Islamic Council, the Dawah Party, and Muqtada al-Sadr. Yeah, there you go. They fought a whole war against Sadr for no reason whatsoever, and just got a whole bunch of people killed and achieved nothing with it. At the same time that they were helping the Mahdi army and the Badr Brigade finish kicking all the Sunnis out of Baghdad. And then the reintegration of the Sunnis politically into the government never happened. The U.S. supported the most Iran-loyal factions who just wanted Shiistan and screwed the Sunnis, which is exactly what they did, which helped lead to the Sunni turn back to al-Qaeda in response. And now the Sons of Iraq and the concerned local citizens that David Petraeus built up, were they integrated into the Iraqi army? No, never happened. They are now what we call ISIS infantry, right? The guys in the suicide trucks. The country is split. Sunnistan will never again be ruled by Baghdad. Mission accomplished. And then the oil law. Again, never happened. The law was passed, but the Kurds and the Shiites have fought over oil rights and money the whole time, with the Kurds cutting their own deals and cutting Baghdad out. Although the Baghdad government, they still have the Basra oil down south. The Sunnis got cut out completely, again, part of why they fight. They lost. The Sunnis, they were the minority, the 20% minority, who ruled the center of the country and the capital of the country and the whole country. But where they were predominant, there wasn't much oil there, certainly not developed. All of the developed oil resources were up in the north in Kurdistan near Kirkuk and down near Basra. And so by losing control of the central government, they were losing control over that oil wealth. Again, part of why they fought so hard in the days of the insurgency in the first place. And then as far as benchmark number five, you can have a bunch of bases and stay forever. Maliki told Bush, thanks for taking the capital from the Sunnis for me. Now get out. And, you know, Patrick Coburn reported this. It was almost comical. It is thinking back on it. Coburn writing about this in 2008, where Bush was saying, hey, I need 56 bases. And then Maliki was saying, oh, yeah, okay, I agree with you. Yeah, let me talk to the guys and see what I can do. And then he was just putting them on and dragging it out. And Bush was going, okay, how about 50 bases? How about 20? What about 19 bases? Could we have 19 bases? And at the end, Maliki was like, I'm sorry, George. I tried to convince the guys, but they just would not go along with the immunity deal. And so you got to go. Thanks for winning the war for us. Now beat it. And so if the surge worked, it worked for Iran's factions that controlled the country and refused to cooperate whatsoever with the Sunnis that they'd driven out of power with America's help. And
and helped lead to the rise of the Islamic State. That's leaving out a lot. I'm not trying to say it's not all Obama's fault for the war in Syria. I'm just saying why was Iraqi Sunni stand ripe for the plucking by the Islamic State? Because they were completely, they had been all declared outlaws and you know, basically been exiled from the Iraqi state. That's why. So, the only thing the war party can try to point to in order to pretend the surge was a success is the completely unrelated Sunni awakening, which was when the local Sunnis turned on the foreign-led Al-Qaeda and Iraq guys who'd been allowed to fight with them against the U.S. and Iran-backed Shia, but had been more trouble than they were worth, having already attempted to declare the Islamic State of Iraq back in 06. Petraeus showed up, handed out a bunch of money and guns, and said, "Hey, keep fighting Al-Qaeda like you're already doing, and I'll accept your repeated peace offers." So instead of defeating the insurgency, all he did was bribe them and accept their terms of truce. Then he promised them that they'd get jobs in the army and the central government would share the oil wealth, etc., none of which came true. And despite the hype, the Sunni insurgency against the Shia never really went away. Just the U.S. stopped fighting them and eventually withdrew to their bases and then left. It was only quiet because they were leaving from way behind Shia lines. I don't mind calling losses victories if it can cover and save face for withdrawal, but unfortunately they use their hyped-up coin crap as a model for escalating the war in Afghanistan, too. You hate government? One of them libertarian types? Or maybe you just can't stand the president, gun-grabbers, or warmongers? Me, too. That's why I invented LibertyStickers.com. Well, Rick owns it now, and I didn't make up all of them, but still, if you're driving around and want to tell everyone else how wrong their politics are, there's only one place to go. LibertyStickers.com has got your bumper covered. Left, right, libertarian, empire, police state, founders quote, central banking. Yes, bumper stickers about central banking. Lots of them. And, well, everything that matters. LibertyStickers.com. Everyone else's stickers suck. All right, you guys, welcome back. I'm Scott Horton. It's my show, Scott Horton Show. Yeah, there's Bobby Jindal talking bad about Rand Paul right now. Might as well quit pandering and fight against him. I'll tell you what, go to original.antiwar.com/Paul and read your father's archives, and you'll be pretty much caught up on what you need to know. Bobby Jindal. All right. It's my show, Scott Horton Show. So I just now kind of scanned through during the break this Nancy Youssef article from 2007 about the benchmarks. And there's like 13 of them, but I think, yeah, most of them are answered by my answers that I already gave. You know, if you look at them now, you can know just by looking at them. Well, obviously the place is still crawling with militias. The Iraqi army hardly exists at all other than their special forces, their so-called Golden Division, Golden Brigade. The rest is all the militias, the Bada Brigade, Asaib al-Haq, and the Mahdi army and whatever else, the Shiite militias. And then, of course, al-Sunnistan is outside of the control of Iraq. Now, how's that for your Met benchmark? And, you know, the Wall Street Journal article that attacked Paul, well, according to The Hill, said, oh, no, everything was fine. It wasn't the only thing that led to the rise of the Islamic State. It wasn't anything the Republicans did. It has nothing to do with Syria. No, it's just because Obama pulled the troops out of Iraq. Well, first of all, Maliki, the democratically, is that what you call it, elected Prime Minister and the parliament, they refused to grant immunity for American troops. It's the American rule that they can't stay in a place like Iraq unless they have permission beforehand to commit war crimes and have immunity from prosecution for any war crimes that they might commit. And without a bargain like that, there's no way they're staying. That was George W. Bush's policy, too. And Bush did everything he could for 8 months, and Maliki told him to get bent. How come the conservatives don't ever mention that? That Obama should have been able to get the deal out of Maliki that George Bush could not to allow American forces to stay. And, okay, it might be true that all other things being equal and whatever, I don't know, equal, all other things being pretend and made up and irrelevant, that, yes, if there were tens of thousands of American forces still in Iraq and with air power, they could have stopped the giant convoy assault on Mosul by the Islamic State a year ago. But all that does is just raise the question of, well, where were they coming from? And where did they get all those Toyota Helixes? They were coming from Syria, where America had helped create the political space for the rise of this jihadi rebellion there. And, you know, there was a nationalist Sunni insurgency in Iraq, and Al-Qaeda in Iraq was always the smallest part of it. Even the generals would admit that it was like, 5% of the insurgency. They never ran it. And when they tried to declare the Islamic State of Iraq, the Iraqi Sunnis turned on them and shot them and marginalized them almost out of existence until Obama came and brought them back to life. Obama and allies came and took the side of the Sunni-based insurgency in Libya, and then especially in Syria, and the field always was dominated by the jihadists. It was never a matter of, oh, yes, there's, as Barack Obama himself admitted when he was not lying for a change, that the idea that we were ever going to build up an army of a bunch of doctors and lawyers and professionals and moderates and nice guys, and that they were going to, we're going to build up a giant army of them. And they were going to be able to take on all comers, right? Al-Nusra, the Islamic State, as well as the Syrian state and its army and Hezbollah, all backed by Russia and Iran on their side. That was a fantasy. That's ridiculous. And that was what really led to the rise of the Islamic State. And they can't really argue the fact, assuming that Rand really has his facts together, well studied, and not in a talking point way, but in a really understands this stuff way, then I think he can kick their asses. I think he can make complete fools out of them. I mean, how in the world does any Republican or Democrat justify a policy of helping the Shiite militias and their Iranian allies and the Baghdad government that America put in power there fight against the Islamic State in Eastern Islamic State, while we're still helping the Sunni rebellion against the secular dictatorship in Western Islamic State, in the land formerly known as Syria before the Friends of Syria helped to destroy it? I mean, that is absolutely crazy. And all Rand Paul has to do is just explain it in simple terms. He doesn't need to, you know, teach a professor's course on it. All he has to do is just call them out for exactly what they said and when and whose side they're on and what side that is. The Al-Nusra Front? Man, those guys are Al-Qaeda in Syria. That's who the Al-Nusra Front is. They're still loyal to Ayman al-Zawahiri, the butcher of New York City. And now, look at this article here where... Hey, where the hell did it go? There's an article here where, yeah, here, look. Syrian Al-Qaeda chief vows no attacks against the West. Demands Alawites leave their religion and leave Assad. Jalani said, promising an Al-Qaeda-ruled Syria would not be used as a launching pad for strikes against the West. I'm standing here beside myself. This is the rebranding. They've said for a long time that this is going to happen. Yeah, what we got to do, we got to rebrand al-Nusra. Hey, at least they're not the Islamic State. Yeah, but why did the Islamic State break away from them again? Because they're still loyal to al-Qaeda, and the Islamic State no longer is? They try to spin it. Oh, Nusra and al-Qaeda broke off from the Islamic State because the Islamic State is too brutal. No. Zawahiri told the Islamic State to go back to Iraq because he thought what they were doing in Syria was counterproductive because it was too brutal. And they told him, screw you, old man. We'll go back to Iraq when we're good and ready. And then they waited a few months, and then they went in and they declared a caliphate in direct contradiction to his orders, which was to not do that yet. So that's what they're fighting about. You know, tactics and strategy and chain of command. Oh, no, but, you know, if this was the 1980s, and foresight would be required, well, then, geez, I guess I understand How one might say, ah, what are we worried about? A couple of stirred up Muslims? As Zbigniew Brzezinski put it about the Mujahideen that the U.S. supported in the 70s and 80s in Afghanistan. They came back, that blew back, and killed so many Americans. But now that that's already happened, and now that America turned Western and Northwestern Iraq into jihadistan for the last 12 years and created 10,000 bin Ladens, just like Hosni Mubarak warned would happen, and spread the damn thing to Syria, we got a policy of helping to spread it. I don't know. Seems like it'd be easy to be Rand Paul right now. Make fun of Bobby Jindal. Oh, yeah, Bobby Jindal. He wants us to fight for Iran in Iraq. Oh no, you want to fight for Al-Qaeda in Iraq? You want to fight for, who is it that we should be backing again? Ha ha ha, you don't know what you're talking about. Shut up, Bobby Jindal. Easy enough argument to win. But no, don't you worry. The Al-Nusra Front, they're Al-Qaeda, but they're not so bad. And look, their leader promises that, yes, he loves Ayman al-Zawahiri, the butcher of New York City, and will obey his every command. But don't worry, once Al-Qaeda rules Damascus, he promises that they're not going to attack the West. They need the West's help to continue to cut the heads off of the Alawites, am I right?
Hey, y'all, Scott Horton here for WallStreetWindow.com. Mike Swanson knows his stuff. He made a killing running his own hedge fund and always gets out of the stock market before the government-generated bubbles pop. Which is, by the way, what he's doing right now. Selling all his stocks and betting on gold and commodities. Sign up at WallStreetWindow.com and get real-time updates from Mike on all his market moves. It's hard to know how to protect your savings and earn a good return in an economy like this. Mike Swanson can help. Follow along on paper and see for yourself. WallStreetWindow.com.
All right, you guys. Please state section. ScottHorton.org. Hey, help support this show at Patreon.com. Donate per show. A quarter. 50 cents. $6. Whatever you want. And you can put a cap on it, too. So in case I do a million interviews, it won't cost you $1 million. You say, oh, limit. However many a month, whatever it is. Donate per interview. That would incentivize me to do more interviews. I do anyway. That's patreon.com/Scott Horton Show. All right, now listen here. Family files lawsuit in police shooting of Fort Worth homeowner. And all that happened was somebody called the cops about a burglar. Cops went to the wrong address. They're in this guy's backyard screwing around with a flashlight and all this. He goes out into the garage. They claim he had a gun in his hand. I don't know if that's even true. I guess no, I think the lawyer said he had a gun, but the cop said put the gun down. He put it down on the back of the car, the trunk of the car in the garage, and had his hands up, and they shot him. An old white man, believe that or not. This happened May 28th, 72 years old, May 28th, 2013 this happened. And all that happened was the cop completely screwed up. He did 6 things against regulation and the steps he was supposed to be taking. And he either was looking for a chance to murder someone, or, you know, he was shaken and scared, and it was a criminally negligent homicide. But then, of course, guess what? They manhandled his wife. Threw her in the cop car, refused to let her go to be with him or to say goodbye or any kind of damn thing like that. And they knew it was a screw-up. They knew the old man hadn't done anything. He was no burglar. He was no criminal. He was in his own garage. But they still treated his corpse and her like, they were Arabs or some kind of half a human. You know, like they were Nazis in a lawless totalitarian dictatorship where there's no reason for them to have the slightest bit of disregard. They're the Gestapo, and if you don't like it, what? Yeah, that's what I thought. And so they manhandled her and, basically disgraced his body. left him laying on the floor there all splayed out, Family Guy style, with her unable to come and, you know, roll him over, close his eyes, tell him she loves him. And then they set about staging the body, moving it all around, telling a bunch of lies, and in a way where they got caught talking about, this is how we should say it. You say this, and then I'll say it like that, and whatever. And they're just completely busted. And they got good lawyers who are going to prove this in a civil suit. Until they settle, I guess. And the point of this is that cops are murderers. And the other point of this is that when you read this article, you will see that when a cop kills somebody, all the other cops, they all know what to do, which is to 100% of the time take his side and do whatever it takes to help him get away with it, no matter what. Does a partner ever arrest a partner in a situation like this? Whoa, you just went way over the line and killed this guy. You're under arrest. Hey, sorry, if you were just a regular person and you took that shot, you'd be under arrest. You're under arrest. Has that ever happened in America? Ever? Ever? No. You know what they all are? They're all guilty accessories after the fact. They're guilty. They're guilty of obstruction of justice. Of 1,000 things that they would nail you to the wall with if you did what they did after murdering this innocent man. Your security force. Oh, you love them so much. Just like this one in the Daily Beast today. Man threatens suicide. Police kill him. His girlfriend says, well, he's got a knife. She calls the non-emergency number to try to get him to a hospital. He's in bed. Oh, he was sober and then fell off the wagon and was drinking from the bottle and was pretty drunk. The cops come in with AR-15s and just kill him. And they say he's a big guy and there's no blood on the walls anywhere, anything. All the blood is in the mattress because he was still laying down in bed. He was laying down in bed. He didn't attack them. He didn't go anywhere near them to attack them. And then here's what he said. Denise Way, Justin's mom, said the detective told her that they told Justin to drop the knife and he didn't. So they shot him because that's what we do. That's her using his words. That's what we do. If you're holding a knife and they say, drop the knife, and you go, huh? Bam, bam, bam. Now you're a dead man. That's it. Doesn't matter whether they really think that they have to kill you in order to not die. All that matters is I can kill now. I am now past the line where I definitely can get away with taking this shot. They take the shot. That sounds like it's not true, but it is true. Here in the Washington Post, this guy wrote about being a cop. That every one of, here he says, I'm certain many other officers in the department would have escalated the situation fast. He's talking about confronting a man with a knife one time. They would have screamed at him, gotten close to him, threatened him, and then any movement from him, even an effort to drop the knife, would have been treated as an excuse to shoot until their clips were empty. In other words, well, are you a male? Ladies, this may not apply to you, but if you were ever a male and you were ever, I don't know, like 7 years old, you remember talking with your friends about, yeah, well, if it was me, somebody ever came to my house, I'd blow them away. Da-da-da-da-da. Oh, yeah, I'd take a shot to be a tough guy and shoot somebody if I was on the legal side of the line and I could. Oh, yeah. Because, you know, that's how stupid little 7-year-old boys talk. Well, that's exactly the thought process of an American cop, all of them. They would have treated a man with a knife. They would have done anything they could to escalate this situation until they have, quote, an excuse to shoot until their clips are empty. Man threatened suicide. Cops walk in with AR-15s. Drop the knife. Bang, bang. Kill him. Dead.
the girlfriend says, man, he wasn't even really suicidal. He was just having a bad time and was saying stupid things. And then the family says, boy, we'll never call the cops on anyone again. Yeah, you think? Maybe you should get out in front of the television and start looking at the Free Thought Project instead at night for your entertainment. You know, I called the lawless, totalitarian, Nazi, Gestapo, stormtroopers of death to take good care of my boyfriend that I love so much, and would you believe they shot him? Yeah, I called the professional assassination squad for help, and they killed the person that I love. You know how many people can say that? Happens every day, every day. And just like this Ferguson cop says, they will look for a chance to escalate the situation so that they can kill, so that they may kill. Anyone with a knife, the first thing they do is just scream at them, threaten them, try to get them to flinch, and then shoot them. Because that's what cops are, man. You know, I remember, I like telling this story about once a year or so. A couple years, anyway. Shannon Burke Show. Long time ago here in Austin, Texas. A guy called in, he said, well, I was a Williamson County, he was an old man. I was a Williamson County Sheriff's Deputy for years and years. And one of my jobs toward the end there was whenever we got new guys, it was my job to take them and ride around with them for a day or two to get them acquainted with the job and that kind of thing. And I would always ask them, why'd you become a cop? And, you know, the real answer is because they're bullies and they want to be bullies and that kind of thing. They like to fight and they want to be on the safe side of the law, that kind of deal. But they all say the same thing. Oh, I just want to help people and this kind of thing, right? And he said, well, this one guy, he asked him, why'd you become a deputy sheriff? And the guy said, well, the way I figure, things around here are getting more and more Gestapo. And I just want to make sure I'm wearing a brown shirt. That's your security force. Lawless killers. Looking for an opportunity to escalate, to have an excuse to kill someone.